I had resolved what was happening in my mind when I started writing the song, which meant that I went back to the beginning of the song and took out "everything's done for you here" and changed it to "everything's done by you here." And that, and "everything's run by you" rather than "everything's run for you," which shifted the whole emphasis of the song around to saying, you must take time for yourself to go inside and get yourself centered so that you can continue to do your work.
Do you go back
out in the world?
Do you go back to your music after it's written a lot and start changing? You know, you were obviously working something out with that song.
Yeah.
You worked it out and came back and changed the workout.
That happened all within one evening. I usually write songs within one or two sittings. I try to do them in one sitting. Otherwise, the song loses whatever it is. It becomes something different. The last verse or whatever I add is a different entity. Some songs, no, though. Some songs, I will write all of them, but I'm not happy with one line, and that will come later. But once the song is done, once I have the verses and the chorus and the bridge and all that stuff, very rarely do I change, unless there's something wrong with it. My sense of what a good song is a song which is inevitable, where everything has to go where it goes. Best Friend is a beautiful example of that in my mind, because by the time it gets to the chorus, the chord changes, the melodic progressions, the rhythm, everything about it brings the song and the audience to the point where the only thing that can happen is the chorus. And the most appropriate response is to sing. I didn't plan that. I consider that a brilliant song, but I did not plan it. It happened that way, and I am humbled by the fact that it came out of me. You know, I am amazed. I think that the song is constructed in a stunning way. It, how the muse, you know, suggested. There, good songs are not arbitrary. They're on purpose, and the pieces that come together on purpose. If I were to diagram out that song, it would make absolute sense why the progression of events, musical events and song, are such that the chorus happens the way it happens, and that's why the audience sings. It's not just because the lyrics are real neat. It has to do with what happens to the audience viscerally in the progress of the song up to that point.
I heard a tape that you did at Full Moon, and when you talked about the first time, you all of a sudden heard people started singing.
Yeah.
And
one of the things that's real beautiful about the music that I am writing, to me, is that it is being made clear that it's accessible to people. And one of the ways that it's being made clear is the fact that people feel free to involve themselves in the song while the song's going on. And the first time that happened to me, I'd only performed Best Friend two or three times, and no one had ever sung along with me. No one had ever shared one of my songs with me. And it just wasted me, just made me cry. It was so beautiful. I now feel like I've gone one step beyond that even with myself, and that is to feel safe enough and to feel at one enough with audiences so that I can stop singing entirely in that song. And one of the beautiful things, listening to the tape of Oakland, the concert that Chris and Meg and Holly and I did in February, was to hear 2,000 people singing it and me playing the piano. You know, I think that's part of what I'm trying to do, is to open up the music, open up my music and share it, open up myself on stage and share myself, open up the experience of being a strong woman and sharing that with all people, I see that as the thrust of what I'm doing, defining out my ideas of what would be a good way to live, how I am trying to live, which is very personal. It also has real political consequences, because I think that there are a lot of people who are trying to do the same thing I am. I don't think I'm an isolated case, you know. I don't think that I'm that unique. How I say it is unique, for sure, and I'm proud to be the carrier of that, you know, ability to say it in that way. But I see the purpose of me being a performer. I mean, I identify now as a performer, and that's something that's come to me fairly recently, you know, like within the last year. And the reason that I identify that way is because I made a decision that that's part of my work, not only to write the songs, but also to present them and to say what it is and to be the way I am and to be as clear as I possibly can. I am performing on purpose. I'm very conscious about what I'm doing. I'm not up there to do the la-las. I'm not up there to be a star. That's not ever why I wanted to be a performer. I am doing work that I see as part of trying to affect social change, trying to present beautiful music, my music, in the best way I know how. I know I'm real good. I know that I'm willing to change and grow, and I want to model that and say to all the people who see me, I am not a finished product, for sure. You know, sometimes I get so excited about what I'm doing that I will forget my lines. That has to be real, you know? And I want to be able to say that. I think it's important for performers, and I see women in women's music. It's another thing that makes us different. I see the women that I work with and the women I see identifying themselves as being involved in women's music, being willing to risk that kind of vulnerability, not out of weakness, but out of strength, out of saying, I will show you me as much as I know, as much as I can, as much as I am right now, tonight. And I mean, for sure, none of us are the end product, none of us. You know, I get real upset with myself and with the other women that I work with, that we make mistakes, that we don't have it all down, that sometimes the introductions of our songs aren't what they should be, or the performances, but I think that we're all aiming for it. Okay, tape three. I think that the artist's responsibility to her audience is directly proportionate to what it is that she makes clear that she wants to do. To hold a woman musician accountable for the material that she sings, if she doesn't know what the alternatives are, I don't think is fair. I think that, to say that a woman who does not have any feminist consciousness should be berated or attacked in any way because she's singing sexist lyrics, I think is a real privileged place to come from, elitist and all the rest of the things that have to do with us not realizing that all women are on a continuum. You know, we're all evolving, we all came from someplace else. I think that, in my mind, my responsibility is, as a woman who has identified herself as being a feminist, as being a woman who is committed to women's culture. Those two things mean a whole bunch of stuff right away. That means that my priority as a musician is working and supporting other musicians that are women. It means that I want to encourage and do everything I can to support women on all levels of women's music. I mean, specifically because that's my area. That doesn't mean that I don't support women's culture in general. I see myself as a cultural worker, but my specific area of expertise is music, and so that's where I put most of my energy in terms of my priority being women. I think it's real important to support women in terms of who I have on stage with me, who works with me, who defines out what my music will sound like once it goes beyond the piano and my voice. The record that I'm going to be doing, that's going to be coming out in September, I hope, if everything goes as planned, will be produced and engineered and put together entirely by women. And the reason for that in my mind is that I want to support women on all levels of production. I want to be a part of helping women who have never had a chance to get the skills, to get them, to offer them experience in the studio. I am not willing to offer up the quality of my music ever, 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 for a what appears to be a political goal. I think that we do ourselves a disservice every time we say, I will offer up the quality of this piece of work to make this political point, because part of the political point is the quality. No one is surprised when the work women do is second rate. No one is surprised. In fact, they expect it. And part of the focus of my work, and especially in this project, because that's what I'm doing right now, is to make the statement that I can put together, and that women can put together, projects, and in my case, put together an album of high quality, beautiful, tenderly cared for music, working entirely with women. I want to make that statement. I want to support the women that have been working in isolation, that have never had a chance to do it. I mean, there are two different types of women there. And also women who are continuing to do it and want to get more experience, or who already have the experience, and who I want to work with, you know. I will be working with some women that have never been in the studio before. There is going to be an apprentice engineer on the project who is going to be learning from a woman who has had stunning amounts of engineering experience, so that she will be teaching another woman, you know. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing will be going on. There will be women who have been in the studio a lot who will be coming in and doing work. It's a real broad range in terms of that.
Earlier on in the show, I talked about Olivia Records, and basically they're doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Why aren't you tying through them instead you're starting your own record company?
Uh-huh. I think that what I am doing is very much like what Kay Gardner has done in New York and Willie Tyson in Washington, D.C. with Lima Bean Records.
Except for her, it wasn't totally female.
No, I'm talking about a woman who decides to start an independent. Awesome. Yeah. No, that's all I'm talking about. I'm not talking about any more than that. Holly Near starting her record company. There are a lot of other women that have done that, too. I feel like at this point in time, it's real important for there to be independent record companies. It's real important that Olivia Records exists as a national women's record company that will record women who don't have the resources to record themselves. I am fortunate enough to have the resources to record myself, which allows and frees up Olivia Records to record a group that doesn't have the resources themselves. And that's a big reason that I'm not recording with Olivia.
So you'll be running studio time?
Yes.
And running into that hassle of running in, make sure it's perfect?
Sure, sure. I'm hoping that I won't offer up the quality of it, of the record, for the big two, which is time and money, and I'm trying to schedule and plan ahead enough, giving myself enough time, first of all, and being real careful with my budget so that there is not waste. And I think that's the thing in terms of the budget, is being real careful and not wasting the time, which then wastes the money. I don't know. I've never done it before. I've watched Meg do her album. I've watched Chris do her album. And I've learned a lot. I mean, I feel like part of the reason that I've been able to start Pleiades Records is because I have been a part of Olivia Records. I've watched Holly and Redwood Records. I've watched Kay Gardner form Urana Records in New York, and have learned that it's real difficult, but it's not impossible. That if you have the resources and have a group of people who have the expertise and the energy and the willingness to build the kind of organization that you need, that you can do it. I think that there's been a myth created and perpetuated in the industry, you know, all along that only men can be engineers, that only men can start record companies, all that stuff, and it's not only in the music business. But
what about distributing the record?
I will approach distribution in three different ways. One is exploring the possibility of distribution through major recording labels, and one is through independent distribution networks, and the third is through mail order. And I'm going to be, and the women that I'm working with are going to be studying all those, all the little ins and outs of those three possibilities, and we may end up doing a little of all of them, depending, you know. I don't know. I want to be sure that I've explored everything on all levels, you know.
So that'll be decided through the summer before the record comes out.
Yeah, based on all the research that we've done.
Why did you find it necessary to start your own publishing company?
I think mainly as a legal and psychological entity. I was offered publishing contracts from Dusty Springfield and from Jackie DeShannon, and also other publishing deals along the way. But they all had one thing in common. All the offers had one thing in common, and that was ownership of the songs, mm-hmm. control of the songs, control of everything I wrote during the period of the contract. And I balked at that. My little artistic soul said, I create these things. These are mine. You can't own them. You can't come in and own my song. And it's, I mean, part of that, I'm sure, is an ego place. There are artists who believe that once they create their thing, then it's for the world, and it doesn't matter who does anything with it. I think that it's real important, especially now, that women value what it is that they do and what it is that they create. It's not for free that I write music. It's my life. I do it 24 hours a day. All my life is aimed at music in one way or another. And that's no joke. I'm not living off a sugar daddy, you know. I'm not living off some source of income that allows me to do it for fun, you know. I am doing it because I am fortunate enough to have all the background that leads me to the point where I can make a living in it. And that means that I place a value on my music. That means that as any artist or any person who has a service of any kind makes the decision about what it's worth so that they can make a living off it, that's what I'm doing. And I wouldn't want to sell. I don't see that you can sell something as intangible as a song. I don't feel I can sell my songs and feel good about it. It makes me feel very uncomfortable. To sell a performance of it, which is what you do when you charge people to come see you, is somehow different than selling the creation itself, you know. It makes me real emotional, and I know that a lot of people have felt that they were forced to do that. And I don't envy them at all. Right? Sometimes in order to get someplace, you have to do something you don't want to do, and I know that part, and there are compromises for sure. And I'm not saying that I would never sell a song of mine, but part of the reason I set up Labyrinth Music Company was so that I could have control over the songs, so that when an artist comes to me and says, I want to record blah, 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 I own it. And it also sets up a legal entity which allows me to do all the paperwork. It also sets up a psychological entity in terms of negotiation so that the artist or the publishing company or the record company isn't dealing with an individual. That's just a business reality. It's dealing with a company. And there's no way they can know who the company is. And I don't tell them. That Labyrinth Publishing Company was set up to deal with the industry. That's why it is what it is. Otherwise, I would just go along being myself. But I think that...
You've been basically forced to get into the whole business angle.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Just as protection. I think that it's real important that women know that, especially if they're artists of any kind, that how your art, how your creative products are managed is no joke, and people will rip you off so fast, and it necessitates sitting down and making a decision. If you're going to make your living with your art, if you're going to make your living your art, then it's real important to take it seriously, take yourself seriously, and figure out how to be protected. And in music, that means, you know, getting a publishing company or working with a publishing company that you trust that will be careful with your music and will do for your music. You know, and I, at this point in time, do not know of a publishing company who would do that for me. If one comes along, then we'll talk.
Yeah, since we're talking about making a living in art,
yeah,
and all that sort of thing, one thing that impressed me with the women's concert, the tour, was that the engineers, the sound people, the lighting people, and the
mm-hmm.
people who were performing were getting the same salary for
mm-hmm.
each performance. That makes it a lot more difficult for you, not making $10,000 every night, but making
$10,000. $10,000.
You're making $130 a night, and you're
yeah.
not performing, you know, every week.
Right.
How are you making a living? What compromises are you having to make? And
I don't think that it's realistic to ask a performer to do concerts for $130 a night. If the performer is doing it for a living, I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's realistic. There are a lot of depending ons in there. There are those of us who are traveling all over the country and are doing more than getting up on the stage and singing, who are helping to organize women's culture, who are helping to start businesses, sound companies, starting production companies, who are really working on a lot of levels beyond just flying in on a plane, getting up on stage, singing and leaving, doing workshops, all those kinds of things. And that, plus the fact that the work we do is not 2 hours. To say $130 for a two-hour concert, that's, $60 an hour. That's a lot of money compared to what a lot of people work for an hour. But that doesn't have anything to do with paying me for all the time it takes me to write a song, all the time it takes me to organize a workshop, all the time that I spend sharing the information that I have, or sitting down and writing articles, or doing interviews, or any of those kinds of things. And that's not generally thought of, I think, when people hear that a musician makes a particular kind of money. I think that the tour was a exceptional event in a lot of ways, one of which was the fees that people were paid. I think that a lot of the women that were paid were underpaid. And that was the only way that we felt we would be able to do what we wanted to do. The idea of equalizing salaries, I think, is something that needs to be thought out and talked over more and more and more. We wanted to figure out a way to pay people that wasn't based on elitist ideas of conceptual people versus technical people. We were trying to get away from that whole way of viewing people's value based on whether they're on stage versus whether or not they've spent the whole day laying cable to do the sound. Why should one be more valuable, and how do you judge who's more valuable? I mean, there's a whole issue of class there and accessibility and privilege and all that stuff. We tried to figure out a new way to do it, and I don't think that we came up with a final. I don't think that's the final on it, or the bottom line.
Are there concerts in the future, and would that then be hashed out again?
I would imagine that every time I would have a chance to deal, or every time I will be dealing with producers, production companies, that will be something that we'll have to talk about. There is no bottom line on it right now, just like there's no bottom line on ticket prices. We will have to go over and over it. Each situation will have to come up and be dealt with the individuals involved that are willing to struggle with it. I mean, some producers and some production companies aren't paying themselves at all, and will, by virtue of the fact that they all do it part-time, we'll pay the performer 90% of the door, you know, or 80% of the door, and that happens a lot. Now, if these people have decided that they want to set up a production company that they're going to make their living on, that changes everything. And those kinds of situations are all individual. Some producers have an independent income, and so they don't take any of the money beyond expenses, and that allows the musician to make whatever the door is. Other places, it's split 50-50. Usually, the performers are paid more than the light crew or the sound crew. That is usually what is done. And I don't know how that will change. Part of what we're talking about is a finite amount of money and an infinite amount of need. You know? Discussions about whether people should be paid according to their need. We did that one. I mean, all of us, and I say all of us, I mean women who are into women's music who have been helping to build the network that we have now in the United States, have been discussing these things as long as we've been doing it, which is, you know, 3 years and before. But, I mean, I've been involved in those discussions for 3 years. Discussing payment on the basis of need, then we talk about what's need, whose need. You know, we're talking about you need new wheels on your car in order for you to do your work. I need a synthesizer in order for me to grow as an artist. Now, what's more important? Whose need is greater? All those kinds of things are still in flux, those kinds of discussions.
I think it's real important that people can make an adequate living from what they do.
Sure.
So much time has been donated.
Yes.
And it's getting and that does sacrifice the quality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting to the point where there's enough people around who know what they're doing and should be able to make a living.
That's right. I see right now there are, you know, 20 of us maybe, 20 or 30 women in the United States who are able to make a living doing women's music. I can't be exact about that. There may be more, but I don't think so. I mean make a living. I don't mean...
Thousands that are doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Part of the reason why there aren't more is because a lot of the women are doing it part-time, you know, and that's their responsibility. You know, when you make a decision to do the work full-time, then there are certain things that change right away. Part of it has to do with what I see we're going to have to do in terms of redefining exactly what the audience's responsibility is in supporting their culture. And that's a lot of it comes down not only to being real careful with what they allow to come across the stage, whether or not they call performers when they're being sexist or racist. If that's allowed to happen, then that's exactly what women's music will be, you know. I'm not talking about trashing. I'm talking about real, clear criticisms that need to be made and discussions that need to be had about the performers. I see that as the audience's responsibility of watching and helping the performers know. Now, I was brought up in Los Angeles in the women's community there as a performer because I never thought of myself that way. I got to learn how to perform by what I was validated
by the things that I did being validated or not validated. And my performance style has everything to do with the women's movement. Now, I was given a lot of space and a lot of care in the way I was treated when I started performing, because I was a baby performer, because I was a woman in the women's community getting up there and trying to do something. Now, women's music exists as an entity. When I started it out doing women's music, I didn't know it was women's music, and no one else did either. And the other women who were doing it didn't know it either. We were doing something, and the women were coming to hear us and loving it. And we were loving that they were supporting us, but we didn't know. And now we know. Now there is an entity called women's music. There are women who identify as doing it. There are particular expectations that audiences have. Some are good and some aren't so good about what women's music will be, what a particular performer doing women's music will do. And for a woman coming into women's music now, wanting to do it, it's tighter than it was.
It's also, you're no longer a baby performer.
No.
And you can now, you know, fill a hall.
Oh, for sure.
People.
For
and
sure.
That creates a distance. There's not as much communication back and forth. And you're going to be making decisions that people don't understand initially. How are you going to deal with communicating the reasons for those decisions and trying to keep that the back and forth communication, the two-way communication?
I felt real sad that one of the things that's happened since I have been working more on a national scale is that I have less time. I don't have a community anymore. Los Angeles was my family in my community, and I feel like we have grown apart, you know. I go back there, and it's like visiting old friends, not sure if they know where I've been, and me not being sure I know where they've been, because we've been apart. I don't begrudge it. I don't begrudge my work at all. I made a choice, and I'm real happy that I did. I think that the work that I've done is real valuable. The work that Meg has done, and Chris has done, Cassie, and all the women who have been on the road setting up and helping to set up things, setting up women's music network in the country. It's been real important, but I feel like it's harder to keep touch. There's less time. To sit down and talk with women after a concert is never a time, never has been a time. But I was able before to go and be around more. Also, there were less people who wanted to know. And now that there are more people that want to know, it makes me very nervous. I feel like sometimes questions are asked of me which are so obvious. People say, you know, now that you're making the big bucks, you know, how can I say to sit down and explain what a production costs. I mean, they see a room, they see 2,000 people, and they assume, and it's not an outrageous assumption, that whoever's filled it is making the bucks. And I'm sure that it was stunning to find out, for people to find out that each one of us made $130. That's low, but not that low compared to what we make. I don't think that it's necessarily good to sit down and have everyone saying, I make this much money here and I make this much money there. All I can say is that we're not making a killing, you know, on our music, doing it the way we're doing it. I feel like one of the things that needs to be recognized and people need to be educated, women need to be educated to the whole mystification of productions and how much it costs. I don't think that it's clear, that it's been made clear how much it costs to put on a production, not counting salaries. And that's the thing. I mean, like, I feel like people are worried that we're, of course, ripping off the community. That's the big, if someone's going to attack, that's where it will come, and that's the most devastating for any of us who are working to build women's culture. That's the most devastating criticism in the world. You're ripping us off.
How do you get over that?
I think sitting down.
Worse, you know?
Oh, it will get worse, I'm sure. If we don't sit and talk with each other and make it clear what the expenses are, I think that we need to say to each other what we're doing for each other. And I work, and all of us work real hard to bring the kind of quality work that we do. 2,000 people, 10,000 people in California didn't come to see us because we were an oddity. They didn't come to see us because we were second rate. They didn't come to see us because we were right on feminists. Although those, some of those things, they could have come from curiosity. Some of them could have come because they wanted us to be second rate and prove to themselves. They could have come for all sorts of reasons, but I would estimate that the largest reason people came is because we're real good. That takes time. You know, the amount of energy that went into that production alone was like 6 months. For some of the people, 12-hour days for 6 months to do that. Now, for those women to walk away with $1,000 is a travesty. Okay?
$2,000 a year, right?
Yeah. You look at a budget that says $1,000 for someone, that's a lot of bucks. It's like we have to redefine what it is. We're not talking about someone just doing sound for a night. We're talking about all the research and work that went into figuring out the house and what the sound equipment would be to do that part so that it would be good. I feel like one of the discussions that we have to have over and over and over again with each other is what the financial responsibility of the audience is. Because for sure, all of us know what our financial responsibility is. We've made a decision. All of us are underpaid. Mm-hmm. All of us. And that's true of women's culture in general, but in women's music specifically, because I know that the best. We're all underpaid, and we have chosen that. But to be then attacked for making too much when all of us already have made decisions around donating our time because of we believe so strongly in what we're doing and building what we're building is heartbreaking. And I've watched all of us come under those attacks, and it's including me. I felt it. It hurts. Not being known, and I think part of that is just not the audience not knowing, the people not knowing what it is that we're doing, what it takes, the amount of time. It's the whole mystification of performers and artists, you know, that you just sit down and write a song, you just get up on stage and do it, you just go to the soundboard and flip the knobs and leave it for the concert. Some sound people do that, but that's not been my experience with the sound women I've worked with in general. Oh, well, for sure, you know, if we could talk about, you talk about the distance, 2,000 people, 10,000 people. Playing in a hall with 2,000 people is nothing like playing at the Full Moon. I think that the last times I've played at the Full Moon, I felt real uncomfortable and real unhappy that it was so uncomfortable for everyone. Mm-hmm. It was so small. We have to take responsibility for that, all of us. When we talk about, God, we're getting so big, it's getting so distant, you know, we're not so intimate as we used to be. There are those of us who have been criticized by turning people away at the door. We've been criticized for having two shows instead of one show, having to turn the house over. We've been criticized for all sorts of things that conflict with each other, you know. I would love to be able to do the Full Moon. Okay, I love the Full Moon. I love doing those kinds of concerts. If I were to go there, even without advertising, what that would mean is only the people, only the women in the Grapevine would get the message. And that is, to me, real privileged right there. Only a certain number would be able to come, which means first come, first serve, which means that the women who have to work to 5 o'clock or whatever and have children, all those kind of women, you know, it narrows it down real fast. And when you set up a situation where more women can come, then you have the problem of distance and the lack of intimacy. The other alternative is doing more concerts, doing more small concerts. I'm not sure that that is feasible or good for performers who consider themselves also artists, writers, you know, writers of music, and also want to rest. I don't want a gig 7 nights a week. I don't want to do that.
Chris played at Wild Side West after the Inez Garcia rally, and it was uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. With the two shows, and women were on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to think of how you get around that.
Yeah.
You know, the choice between having 50 women stuffed into a room, or 100 women,
mm-hmm.
or 2,000 for
yeah.
women.
I mean, we can do, I think that there is something in between there. I think that we can decide that we will come into a city and do 4 nights, you know, at a place that seats 200 people. What needs to be understood by the audience is that that's 4 shows for the performer, and that's, you know, it's 4 chunks of getting up and getting down, concert-wise, as opposed to doing it all in one night. Now, that's just one of the ways of looking at it, you know. The logical extension of that, of course, is to do 1 concert with 18,000 people, and that's I would not want to do that. 2,000, to me, is just about the outside. I could see everyone when the lights were on. When the lights are off, you can't see anyone anyway. Mm-hmm. But I could see everyone. I wouldn't want it bigger than that. I mean, there are possibilities that I may perform for audiences bigger than that, but I would not choose to have that happen regularly. That's the intimacy is part of what women's music is about. I mean, we have all come, the women who have been in women's music the longest amount of time, have all come from communities. And they're all communities that started out being in our audiences with like 50 women, 25 women, you know. I don't want to lose those women. Those women have been with me from the beginning. They were the ones that were there. They're the ones that supported me and encouraged me. And what I want to say to them is, I know you're there. I never forgot you, and I never will. I carry you with me everywhere. You make it possible for me to go to Allen Hancock Junior College and sing to an audience of college kids and old people from the concert series, season ticket holders. You know, you make it possible for me to go into college night, date night at Colgate University. Your support and the strength of that you have helped me find in myself make it possible for me to do those kind of reaching out concerts that are way beyond the women's community, way apart from. I see women's music having to go there if we are going to step outside a very kind of privileged place that we have. The women's communities are beautiful, and my favorite concerts are those, the Lone Mountain concert on Saturday night in San Francisco in December of last year for the Inez Garcia benefit that I did. It was like coming to town for the first time, doing really my first full evening concert for the women of the San Francisco Bay Area's community. And I mean, it was like coming home. It was like saying, I know you've known about me, and I've heard about you, and here we are, and we're going to do it for the first time. That kind of intimacy does not exist in an audience of 2,000 people. It's different. Knowing how we got to know each other in that concert in December allowed me to feel comfortable with the audience in San Francisco in February, because I knew that there were 600 women there that knew all about me, you know. And I say all about me, meaning as what I'm trying to do with my music, having seen me. And I think that that's true, that when we do our women's only concerts and when we do open concerts, they both need to exist together. I don't see it being healthy at all for us to do only open concerts, only big concerts. I think that there have to be all different kinds. I love doing concerts for women only. There is a feeling that exists there that has to do with us coming together and looking at how beautiful we are and how strong we are, that's absolutely essential for us to plug into from time to time. I also know that there are women who, because of their culture, because of their race, because of their class, do not feel comfortable in that audience. And I want to be a part of setting up situations where they feel comfortable too. And I feel like we have to work all the time around how to work out new ways to do it. How can we make all the different kinds of people that each one of us want to reach feel safe? You know, my priorities are real different than some of the other musicians in women's music. All of us have different emphases. Our goals are to reach women. You know, that is the priority of each one of us. And the question is how we want to do it and what our priority will be, what kinds of women, you know.
It's one of the reasons that you want to go, let's say, through a major label with your record. so that you can get to more people?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would not offer up control of my promotion in a way that would make me look like someone I'm not in order to get the major recording label to distribute it. That's the difference. Of course I'm going to pursue that. Absolutely, because that will get the music out. I feel it's my responsibility to do that. I mean, great, I have this beautiful thing, I have this beautiful record, but I'm only going to keep it over here in this place. No way, no way.
But
I will
get flack for it.
Sure, I'll get flack. Mm-hmm. I think that any woman who goes beyond a particular known area, a particular quantity, known quantity, regardless of what, if it's the women's community, if it's the industry, there are those who would like to limit all women, and they come from all different angles of the world. And I think that for sure, I see a human tendency that is not, that the women's communities and the women's movement has not altogether dealt with, to shoot down any woman who forges ahead or steps out and becomes more public. I think questioning is real important. I think asking questions of any woman who would speak out as a representative or who is being looked at. I mean, even if we don't say we are spokeswomen for women's culture, we are, by virtue of the fact that we have exposure and people are asking us questions. It is absolutely essential that the women's communities watch what we're doing, because there's no way to know when any one of us may get winged out and start thinking we're speaking for someone we're not speaking for. And so it's real important for the women's communities to watch, you know. Don't blindly trust.
But to trust.
But do not assume that we will sell you out. Do not assume that as soon as the industry carrot is dangled, that we will give over everything that we have learned together and offer it up for the big contract. No way. I turned down contracts before I even understood what feminism was, and I turned them down because they wanted control over me. And I believe the same now. I will turn down any offer, regardless of where it comes from, if it means limiting me. And to have people say, you're real messed up for limiting yourself to this women's music thing. If you just didn't label it, you could go a lot farther. It'd be a lot easier to merchandise you. That's my choice. And I'm doing it consciously, and I'm doing it for a purpose. I'm doing it for something beyond myself and also something to do with me. When the women's movement or any individual who defines herself as part of the women's movement or speaking from a concerned group in the women's movement says, what you're doing over here is